Today's episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Start building your website today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED at checkout to get 10% off. That's squarespace.com and offer code CRACKED. Today's episode is also being brought to you by Howl.fm, Howl.fm. It's like Netflix for podcasts, and Howl Premium now gives you exclusive access to dozens of Howl original miniseries, the amazing two-episode show, Good Question, with Jack O'Brien. Dan O'Brien has like 6 episodes of his original series up, and you now get access to a bunch of Super Ego, which is literally the funniest podcast that's ever been created. It's made by doctors Matt Gourley, Jeremy Carter, Mark McConville, and Paul F. Tompkins. You can access it all on your iPhone, your Android phone, and on the web for only $4.99 a month. And if you use the promo code CRACKED at checkout, you get a full month for free. That's Howl.fm. I turn the Ritz into a pool house. It's like eviction number 4 now. Go ahead and ash it on the floor now. Girl, go ahead and show me how you go down. And I feel my whole body peaking. And I'm fucking anybody with their legs wide. Getting faded with some bitches from the west side. East coast, nigga, reppin' north side. Never waste a host time. Bitch, I'm on my own time. Fuck a nigga cosign. Always change my number and my phone line. Baby, hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're listening to Low Life, which is a dope song from Future's new album / mixtape, Evil. It's Love Backwards. A great song, appropriate for this week's episode because, first of all, it's a dope song and this is a dope podcast, but also because it's about getting evicted multiple times for drinking and partying and general shitty, immature behavior, ashing on the floor indoors. And that's an appropriate place to start because this week's episode is a journey, and our journey starts with an eviction of sorts. So we're talking about the troubled teen industry again this week, which, as we talked about a few weeks ago, takes bad kids out of their homes, often by kidnapping them, and puts them in environments that range from Lord of the Flies to the orphanage in Oliver Twist. Kids have been beaten to death, starved to death, and other hilarious things. Welcome to our comedy podcast. Anyways, last time we brought you the testimony of an expert,
Maya Solovit,
who literally wrote the book on these, quote, reform centers, and told us, first of all, how common this is.
Literally tens of thousands of American kids have been through this. It's a very, very common experience for people to have, and yet it's one that so few people know about, and it's basically got less regulation on it than nail salons in most states.
She also told us how bad it gets.
Pretty much everything short of waterboarding. Literally people who are, like, chained for hours, who are deprived of sleep for days, who are beaten senseless, who are ignored when they have medical conditions that clearly require help. People have died in that situation. You've had people made to eat their own vomit, gagged with Kotex. Real torture stuff here.
This so, pretty bad. Anyways, we conducted a third interview for that episode with a woman named Darlene, who ended up in one of these homes when she was a teenager in the 80s, and her story ended up being so compelling that we decided to give her her own episode. This episode's gonna be a little different. It's one long story, so we're gonna kind of Radiolab it a bit with me kind of holding your hand as we jump around. You'll see what I mean. But this isn't like a B-side that didn't make the album. It's more like we sat down and she just started dictating an entire feature film to us. And we just sort of sat there eating popcorn. And by the time she was done, we were like, well, this
has to be its own episode, clearly. Throughout her story, very intermittently, you'll hear Robert Evans and me jump in with a question or two, but for the most part, it's just her kind of rolling through these memorable events from her early teenage years. Robert Evans is the head of the personal experience section of the site and the person who brought this story to our attention. He's on the phone. You'll hear his voice once in a while. You'll hear me in studio. So the person we're talking to, like I said, is...
My name is Darlene Molina, and I was a victim of Bethesda.
So a few things to know up front is that a bunch of this stuff is going to sound pretty far-fetched, but pretty much all of it has been documented and is part of the public record. I'll explain why that is at the end of this episode. So the story that's so crazy that I'm having to offer all of these disclaimers up top starts with a pretty normal kid, actually. A lot of these kids get put in these prison camps for doing stuff that the rest of us, when we were shitty teenagers, just happened to get away with. Some of the time, in my case, I was pretty bad at getting away with stuff. If you're even a little bad in high school, though, you can probably identify with Darlene, or you probably had a friend like her. Smart, kind of troubled. Up to age 13, she's actually a really good student, and then her father dies, unexpectedly, of a heart attack. Which is devastating to her, because she'd always been incredibly close to her father, and it's also just practically extremely problematic from a family dynamic perspective, because she and her mom just don't get along, have never gotten along, and her dad had always sort of been the peacekeeper.
He was really kind of abusive to me throughout my childhood, and it just kind of escalated at that point because she couldn't hold her temper. She had a very quick temper and would just lose it. And I push people to the limit, you know, and so it was a really bad combination.
So she ends up acting out in the way teenagers do. She starts smoking pot, drinking, and one day she goes with her friend to get drunk on the roof of the elementary school down the street, which such a high school juvenile delinquent thing to do in that it's the worst idea ever. Or at least it was the worst idea ever until they get drunk and decide to walk home from the elementary school in broad daylight, still drinking out of a liquor bottle, just begging to be the subject of a sobering episode of the Crack Podcast years in the future. And as they're walking down the street, drinking like a couple of cartoon winos, Darlene's mom drives by.
And the brake lights come on. Because she drives by and sees us, and Debbie's got the bottle up near. She hits the brakes, and my house is, you know, just but a few houses in front of her, and we both knew we were just in so much trouble. Debbie's first reaction was to hurl the bottle into bushes of the house that, you know, we were in front of, like, it was too late. Anyway, I go home, go straight up to my room. She calls me down. Debbie's mother, Debbie, my mother is all down there, and like a trophy in the middle of the coffee table is that bottle of cheap wine.
So, yeah, there's a stern talking to. She thinks that's it. And then a few days later, she's at her high school, you know, out in the smoking section. I don't even know if high schools still have smoking sections, but the place where all the bad kids smoke behind the school. And she turns around and sees her mom with a cop.
And my first instinct was run. But something in my gut told me, no, she's not stupid enough to play her whole hand right here. So I just thought, well, you know what, I'm going to play this game and I'm going to go quietly. And the deal was, get in the car, we're going to the airport. And I said, where are we going? She said, well, you know, I've had all these problems with you, and I'm going to send you to a school where they can do you some good. And I thought, oh, boy.
There was a police officer there? What was he doing there?
He was just walking alongside of her. I think, obviously, he was there in case I bolted or, you know, became physical or something. You know, you can call an officer to say, look, I'm going to have to go get my things from my ex-boyfriends or whatever, and I don't know if there's going to be trouble. They'll just come and stand, and if nothing bad happens, you know, they don't interact with you at all. They're just kind of there. Their presence is there.
By the way, I didn't know that that was a thing you could do, have a cop escort you to do something where you think people might get violent. That completely changes how I tell my wife I've made a stupid purchase from now on. Anyways, her mom and her get on a flight.
fly out there, and a couple of young women pick us up. They look like they were barely 20 years old. We get in this car with them, and they drive and drive, and I mean, it was hours. And we end up down this dirt road forever, and I'm looking around, and I'm thinking, oh, wow. I'd never been out of California before. Here I am in Mississippi, Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and we are way off the beaten path. So we pull into this drive, and the headlights splash across this big billboard, and it's painted in red, white, and blue, and it says in big letters, Bethesda, Home for Girls, and underneath it, it says, Christ is the answer. And I thought, son of a... because, like I said, we weren't a particularly religious family, so I did not see this coming. We turn past the billboard and pull up to this plain-looking kind of dormitory, and there's this lady, she's silver-haired, very schoolmarm-like. That's the only way I can think about it, like a 1950s school teacher or something. The lady was very, you know, welcoming, you know, welcome to the school and come in. And so we go in, and it's late, very quiet and dark. And this was the tour she basically gave my mother. And she's telling her, you know, this is where they eat. And she's showing all the tables stacked up in the back in the kitchen area. And she's explaining to my mother that, you know, we will be working out of Christian workbooks at our own pace. At any rate, my mother, you know, she's just going along with the whole thing. And this lady had a great spiel. She should have been a used car salesman, making it sound like it was summer camp. Then she apologizes where she can't show my mother the dorms because it's time for everybody's in bed and they're asleep. My mother says, oh, that's fine. You know, she understands. And you can already tell she was, like, ready to go. She goes, you know, I don't want to miss my plane. She was just, like, you know, kicking me out the door. Like, right. Yeah, okay, great. Let me sign here and I'm out.
So her mom buys this sales pitch. And to be honest, I don't have kids yet, so I can't say whether I would do the same thing or not, but I totally see why she does what she does. She's overwhelmed. She's probably tried and failed to reach her daughter a dozen times. And these people are telling you what you want to hear. Your daughter's bad. You're right to be frustrated with her. And this is what we do. We teach bad kids like your daughter how to behave, and it's fun, and kids need rules, and this is just how it works. And so her mom's like, peace, and she's gone. And that's when, to quote the creepy little girl at the beginning of Liquid Swords, that was when everything changed.
So I got in bed, and it wasn't probably 15 minutes after I had laid down, and I was just, you know, my mind is whirring. Obviously, I'm not sleepy. I am just, you know, my mind is going 100 miles an hour. And all of a sudden, I hear the loudest commotion. The doors that came into this hall, they also had chains and heavy locks hanging off of them that were not chained at the time, but I heard them being chained after we had come in.
Oh, wow.
And we were locked in there every night like that. Fire hazard, we would all have died. If a fire would have ever broke out in there, we would have all perished. I heard a big crash, and it was like this girl appears in the doorway running at full speed, and as soon as she crosses through our doorway, a bunch of counselors just dogpile on her. They tackled her. She's screaming. She's
Holy
in
shit.
Jeans. You know, she had obviously just came in and decided, screw this, you know, I'm out of here. And they took her down and took her down hard. And I was like, oh, crap. At that point, I realized these people meant business. They were not afraid to put their hands on you, and they were definitely not afraid to hurt you. So this changed the whole game for me.
Okay, so this is the, to quote the town, the not fucking around crew, which is unnerving because this is supposed to be a school for children. You shouldn't have to fuck that little around at a school for children. You shouldn't have to chain the doors. And the next day, she gets a look at her new life, and it becomes a lot clearer why girls would be making a break for it and getting unceremoniously form tackled by three staff members like it's the third time they've had to do it that night. That encounter makes a lot more sense when you hear what a typical day at this school is like.
So a typical day, so Monday comes along, the devotions, then you get up and you get dressed and it's time for breakfast. You line up, you go to the little window, and they serve you just like a school, you know, like in elementary school where they hand you, and here, this is what you get, you know? I mean, you don't have a choice. And they had this wonderful thing there called fasting. It was really starving, but they called it fasting because they could claim it was religious. For religious, you know, it's supposed to cleanse your soul. I think it was just a real money saver. Breakfast was an ice cream scoop of oatmeal and one of those little teeny cartons of milk. And there was like three meals that we had, and we had them over and over and over, and once in a great while, it'd be something different, but normally it was the same thing. Lunch was like an elementary school cafeteria-style meal. But dinner, the last meal of the day, usually was two halves of a canned peach and an ice cream scoop of cottage cheese, two graham crackers, and a glass of water. That's it. That is what you're going to bed on that night. And in the morning, and you're going to fast again with, you know, a little bit of oatmeal or something. We were starving all the time. I mean, my stomach was constantly growling. There was no snacks. There was no candy. There was nothing. During the main meal, which was lunch, you know, during midday meal, they would, you know, at the end of the meal, if there was more food left over, they would first holler out, skinny girls, and, you know, yell, skinny girls. And that meant that anybody who was real skinny could come up and get a second serving. And if there was still food left over, they would yell out normal girls, and girls that were apparently supposed to be of average weight could get up and go get another helping. And if there was still food left, they would yell out fat girls at the top of their lungs. And it was just as horrifying for everybody else as it was, I think, for the girls that were obese, because there was several morbidly obese girls there. And you could just feel their shame. They would get up and their faces would be beet red. They'd be looking at the floor and trudge up there. You could just tell they were just like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to get all this judgment. But I'm sure, just like the rest of us, they were just so hungry. It was probably the most demoralizing thing I've ever seen. It was just really a horrible thing to do. Besides the showers, shower time was another demoralizer. They had a big room with about 20 shower heads. They only would turn three on at a time. We all would line up outside of the shower room. So we all lined up out there. We had to strip and be standing there in line, butt naked. They would then order us, you know, somebody at the front of the line, a counselor who was dressed, would, you know, you go to that shower. They'd tell us which one to line up in. You had 60 seconds under the shower head. You got in line. You got two trips for sure. You could have an optional third. The first trip you were supposed to get wet, and then get back in line and soap up while you're waiting in line again. Then when you go out through the second time, you can rinse the shampoo and soap off your body. And then you could go back a third time if you needed to shave or wanted to use conditioner for your hair. But there was a counselor at the head of each shower with a timer, and 60 seconds was how much time you got under the water each trip. And literally, they'd be 15, 14. I mean, when it got down to, you know, less than 15 seconds, counting down the seconds. And if you didn't step out of that shower stream at, you know, the 1 second mark, you would get whooped. I mean, you would get paddled. See, now you could get beat for just about anything. You know, being a new girl, and I didn't get a chance to explain that really quickly. For the first 3 months that you're there, you're called a new girl, and you are assigned a helper. Mine was Becky. You have to remain within arm's reach of your helper at all times, even when you have to go to the bathroom. You know, if you got to go poop, guess what? Your helper's going with you. You go to the toilet, the door has to remain cracked 3 inches, and your helper is going to stand there with her back against the door while you go to the bathroom, and it's horrifying. And if she has to go to the bathroom, you get to do the same thing with your back to the door. No matter where she was going, you had to be, you know, right there, like you're on an invisible leash. Anyway, the whoopings for if you looked at another new girl, if you spoke to another new girl, even if another new girl was talking to somebody else and you commented on that conversation, not talking directly to her, but just on the subject, that was a whooping. If you looked at a new girl's things, like if she had a teddy bear on her bed and you looked at her things, that was a whooping.
Yeah, it's like the Stanford Prison Experiment if it were sponsored by Jesus and never ended, and also if it actually happened. The Stanford Prison Experiment is mostly an urban legend. The version we all know is based on the account of the guy who designed the experiment for the express purpose of proving the thing we all think it proved. But when they went back and interviewed the people who actually were involved in the experiment, they were like, nah, it wasn't that bad. But it turns out if you put children and undereducated 18-year-olds in a closed environment and apply corporal punishment and do it all under the guise of absolute power, you're gonna get those results he was hoping to get with the Stanford Prison Experiment, but couldn't quite get because you're not allowed to physically torture humans for the sake of experiments. That's what lab rats are for, or unruly teenage kids in this case. Anyways, as you heard, she skipped right over the fact that there's whooping taking place. So eventually I asked her what those were like and how that worked.
So, and what was a whooping? That was one of the counselors would just take a paddle to...
Worse than I expected.
No. It would either be Mama or Papa. They made you call Betty and Bob Wills Mama and Papa.
Ugh.
That's what you had to call them. You could not call them Mr. and Mrs. Wills. You had to call them Mama and Papa. And you would go in there in your little skirt or your dress, because remember, there's no pants allowed, and lean over. They'd make you lean over the desk, and Mama would be watching, and Papa would paddle you, which is not creepy at all.
No. So eventually, almost inevitably, she and her friends decide to plan a prison break, and it's really impressively complex and convoluted. It's very like Ocean's 11 meets Shawshank Redemption, if those movies start a bunch of 14-year-old girls.
Out. Well, this one girl, Patty, she gets put, you know, with our group one day. She comes in and she says, her mother said, I need you to go to this school, and I tell you what, I'll make you a deal. If you go, I will give you a code phrase to write in the letters, and if you tell me that code phrase, I'll know to yank you out. And that's the only reason why the girl went peacefully, is because she thought she had a way out. Her mother was lying, unfortunately. She had no intentions of letting her out, but she made her believe that. So we thought, she's going to be able to get out. She says, all I have to do is ask her if my dog had puppies. She said, my dog spayed. It can't have puppies. So we're like, this is brilliant. You know, because they made you write a letter home every week, and they read through it, and if you said you missed home or anything, they made you rewrite it. So you couldn't tell anybody anything. So we thought, okay, great, you're going to get out. How can we get some letters out with you to you know, tell parents? We came up with this plan to get names and addresses of parents and anybody else of interest and put it in code in the Bible. We were forced to take our Bible with us everywhere, and they expected you to be underlining stuff and highlighting things, and, you know, like you really gave a crap, right? Well, this is what we did. We came up with a code that, let's say somebody's address was, you know, 4321 Charles Street. We would, you know, find a 4, take a specific color, like a red pen, find a 4, circle it, find the next number, circle it. Once the numbers are done, then you start with letters, underlining until you got the address. It may take 2 or 3 pages, but you could read through that colored ink and get a full address and phone number out of it and name and all that. And we did this on multiple pages where they would overlap each other. So there'd be, you know, an address in red, there'd be an address in blue, there'd be an address in black, you know, and it just looked like somebody had, you know, marked interesting, you know, chapters or whatever. We got a little too loose where we were, like, telling everybody. It grew and it grew until there was probably 20 girls involved. And, you know, when you have a whole lot of people knowing stuff, somebody's going to narc you out. And that's what happened. One day, we actually got to go outside for, like, the first time that I'd been there. And they had a little softball game. And the girl that was playing center field, you know, made this dramatic run over towards my side to catch a ball. And as she passes by me, she goes, Sherry got saved last night. And that's all she had to say, because I knew that somebody who thinks they got saved is now going to want to confess everything. And this girl, Sherry, she was involved in this plot as well. So I thought, oh my goodness. Well, we get back to the dorm, you know, and they bring us back in. And I had written 2 letters, 3-4 pages each to my mother, telling her everything that was going on, and sealed them up. I put one in a teddy bear. I took the stitching out, put the letter inside, took some of the stuffing out, put the letter in, sewed it back up again, and another one in a purse lining. And these items were supposed to leave with this girl when she was going to get out, which wasn't going to happen, but we didn't know that. We thought she had the for sure thing. So I get to our room, and a few minutes later, Lisa, who was a brutal, brutal person, she's one of the counselors, which counselors were just girls there who had nowhere to go when they maxed out at 18 because they came from a crappy home or a judge sent them there and their parents were too poor, and they were offered to work there. And these were the people, really, that watched over us all the time. Just kids. So you can imagine there was a lot of abuse going on there with power. But anyway, she came and she leads me up to the office, and she's just got this smirk on her face. And when I walk in, there's Mama sitting at the desk, and she's peering over her glasses at me with her hands clasped in front of her. There's the teddy bear. There's the purse, gutted. The letters are arranged on her desk, like fanned out. I'm like, oh, goddamn. Everybody was instructed not to speak to me, not to look at me, not to mention my name. I was dead, as far as anybody concerned. I did not exist. And I was not to look at anybody, speak to nobody. I mean, it was surreal. And I felt like a non-person, just like I didn't exist. This went on for 3 days until one night, about 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm woken up by Lisa, the harsh one, and she says, get up, pack your stuff, you're going home. And I'm like, oh my, I thought I won the lottery. I'm jumping up and down, and 1.5 hours later, we're driving to the airport. We walk in, and Lisa hands me a handful of change, and she goes, your mom wants you to call her. And she's got this look on her face like she just smug. And I'm like, whatever, bye, bitch. And I go to the payphone and I call my mom and I'm so excited. I'm like, I'm going home. And my mom goes, oh, I told them not to tell you that. And I'm like, what? I turn around. They're already gone. They've walked away, left me in the middle of this airport. And she says, no, you're going to another school. I said, I'm sorry? She said, well, but you're going to the same school Debbie's at. Like, that was my consolation prize.
Anyhow, who is Debbie again? That was somebody that you were in that school with?
Yeah, that's who she was drinking the Boone's Barn with.
Right.
Oh, got it.
Yeah, sent to the school she went to. This is, you know, like, there's your consolation. You're not going home, but you'll get to see Debbie again. Which, in hindsight, was a really bad idea to put us back together again. And it backfired in a big way.
All right, so that's our cliffhanger where we're going to stop and take a break. And believe it or not, her story gets even crazier from there because her mom isn't ready to deal with her shit again. And therefore, the troubled teen industry isn't through with her yet. But first, we're listening to Abducted by Cults, great song from about 5 or 6 years ago, which is appropriate, bordering on a little on the nose, to be honest, but fuck it, you know? Pretty song about being abducted. I hope you enjoy it and enjoy these words from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Loot Crate, a monthly subscription box service for geek and gamer items and pop culture gear. For less than $20 a month, you get 4 to 8 items. That's not 48. That would be too many items. That is 4 to 8 items that include licensed gear, apparel, collectibles, and they guarantee $40 of value in every crate, sometimes more. And like I said, it costs less than $20. So you're already in the black. And if you go to lootcrate.com/cracked and enter cracked at checkout, so that's 2 cracks. You got to put it in the URL and then enter it at checkout. You can save $3 on any new subscription. Previous crates have included items from Star Wars, Marvel, The Legend of Zelda, and last month was dedicated to The Walking Dead, which is a show that, statistically speaking, you probably enjoy. The theme of this month is Versus, not like a Shakespeare sonnet, but V-E-R-S-U-S, as in Batman versus Superman, Alien versus Predator, Daredevil versus Punisher. Remember, the deal is you only have until the 19th of this month at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight East Coast time to subscribe and receive that month's crate. And when the cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. You can't get that month's crate anymore. Go to lootcrate.com/cracked and enter code cracked to save $3 on your new subscription today. This episode is also sponsored by Squarespace. Building a website, as we've talked about before, is very difficult. You know that unless you're a web designer. Actually, scratch that. You know that especially if you're a web designer. I know that because I built crack.com with Sebastian, the Romanian web developer, in a moldy office in the Whig district of New York City almost 10 years ago. The first floor of our building was a wig shop that said real human hair on the outside. It would have been so much easier if there had only been a smart, easy way for me to build a website from my own web browser. If only we had Squarespace in that tiny little office, life would have been so much easier. I wouldn't have had to have sold my body hair to that wig shop every day. Squarespace provides easy-to-build websites that look professionally designed regardless of your skill level, no coding required. For only $8 a month, you get a beautiful website that looks good on literally any device. And also, you get free 24/7 online customer support. Whenever you have a question, there's going to be a person there to help you out. And you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for a full year. So start your free trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. And when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, use offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for us, the Cracked Podcast. Thanks, Squarespace. Okay, real quick. So I'm going to mostly let her tell her story here in the second half because it really just gets rolling and you don't really need my help. But real quick, I find it interesting that her friend who got busted drinking with her, Debbie, was put in one of these schools too, which confirms a suspicion I've had about the troubled teen industry, that sending your kids to one of these schools is not something you do in isolation. It's like a really cruel meme that goes viral in a small community. One teacher or counselor or parent has a relationship to one of these schools or just has heard good things about one of them, and they become like the monorail guy from that Simpsons episode. They go around pitching the idea around town almost accidentally, and on its surface, obviously, in the cold and sober light of day, it's straight out of a British dystopian whatever world the album The Wall takes place in. While that's clearly the psychotic hallucination you're sending your kid to live in, people will do a lot of shit if they think other people are doing it. Anyways, Darlene and Debbie are a little like Compton and Long Beach in that now the troubled teen industry, you know you're in trouble.
I get sent to Michigan. I'm spy on this big
fucking
plane.
Fucking Michigan.
I have
Jesus.
To transfer to a small plane, and I end up in 8 feet of snow. Not Michigan, I'm sorry, Wisconsin. Literally snow past the windows. This place had a whole different approach. They didn't lock the doors. They didn't lock the windows. Bethesda had tape alarm on the windows, chains on the doors. This place was like, go ahead and run. Where are you going to go? There's 8 feet of fucking snow out there, and we're in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it was literally, you were out in the middle of fields. It was just ridiculous. So as soon as I went there, the kids were telling me, because you got paddled there too for certain stuff, and I said, oh, big deal, you know, whatever. They said, well, if you're really bad, they'll send you to a roll-off school, which was what Bethesda was. Bethesda was part of the Brother Lester Roloff school, very well known. He's all over the internet. But I told him, I said, I just got kicked out of a roll-off school. And it was like instant street cred. They were all wide-eyed looking at me like, you did? Like, oh
is
my
that,
God.
Is that what had happened? They kicked you out because you were too much trouble?
I didn't know what happened. Nobody told me a damn thing. I didn't find out till years later. What actually happened was, because earlier that year, Bethesda had been sued in federal court for abuse. They accused them of brainwashing the girls, starving the girls, beating the girls, pretty much everything they actually did. And I don't know why it didn't stick. Nothing ever sticks with these people. They start crying religious persecution, and somehow they slither away, you know, and all they ever got charged with was contempt of court. But they had witnesses. Even the, you know, the therapists were saying these girls, it's like being in a concentration camp. They're damaged. And it's still, they got away with it. But at any rate, they got sued for all this. And so apparently they were being a little more careful, and they had altered their contract now so that they had to have parents sign saying, yes, I agree that you can beat my child, basically, you know, we're going to paddle them, but they would only beat us no more than 15 paddles or 15 individual whacks in a 24-hour period. Apparently, my crime was so heinous that they wanted to go way above and beyond the 15 whack limit for that day, so they called my mother and asked permission to basically beat the living crap out of me, and she was like, okay, nope. Anyway, I didn't know it, but when my mom pulled me out of there, she was forced by contract to pay the entire year tuition. I'd been there 3.5 months. She had to pay it right now. So what happened was my Oppenheimer money market fund that my father had made one for me, made one for my brother, and we were supposed to get them at age 18, got given to the Wills. And I didn't find out until I turned 18 and asked my mother for my Oppenheimer money market fund money. And she went, oh, I spent that on sending you off to that boarding school and all that. So, you know, they robbed me of quite a few things, in my opinion. All of that for, you know, who knows how much it was. It was like 10 grand a year or something like that, I believe. I read in court documents that these people made $2 to $3 million a year. They were not doing the Lord's work like they claimed. They were living the good life.
You know,
it was really something.
That's incredible. So now you're at this new school in the middle of Wisconsin in eight feet of snow.
Yeah, in 8 feet of snow. And there's only about 10 of us there. This was a transition house, apparently. The main school was in Illinois, and it was like an old college that had been converted, you know, that somebody had bought this college that apparently failed at some point. So, you know, they're explaining to me that you'll be here for 30 days and to help you transition to being away from home and all that, and I'm like, whatever, you know. Well, I wasn't there a week and a half, and Child Protective Services comes barging in the door. I kid you not. And, you know, they come in with their clipboards and their very stern faces, and you could just see the counselors that were there, they just lost their shit. You could see they were nervous as hell. This was not a first visit from the Child Protective Agency. They'd been there before. I could tell. Nobody told me that, but it was just, you could tell by the interactions that was going on. They went down in the basement where we had, like, an area to do crafts or whatever, but hanging on the wall in the basement, and these people are idiots, was a paddle, and there's some snappy saying written on it about, you know, spoil the child, or spare the rod, spoil the child, or something like that, with permanent marker written on this thing, and it's hanging on the wall. Well, they took that. That was the first thing they gravitated towards. They pulled that off the wall, and they started interviewing some of the other kids that had been there quite some time. The only ones they didn't interview was me and another girl who came in just after me. So, you know, I was, again, getting a sense they had been there already. They got up to leave, and everybody's really quiet. We're all listening. You know, everybody wants to hear what's going on. And they made it very clear they would be back, you know, probably with a warrant. When they left, it was like mayhem. The counselors there were like, pack a suitcase, just a single suitcase. Don't get everything you have, just one suitcase, and let's go. And they loaded us up in a church van and took us across state lines. I don't even know how far it is from Wisconsin to Illinois, but it was a long, long drive. It took several days. We spent the night in a basement of a church. It was like we were fugitives. It was just ridiculous. Basically, they kidnapped us and took us across state lines to avoid whatever prosecution or whatever was going on there. They just abandoned that place. And we were headed to the main school. One night we stayed at, I'm guessing, a sympathetic church member's house, and there was girls. We met up. There was another group of girls there, so I gave me the impression there was transition houses, you know, in several locations, because we met up with another crowd there, and they were all going to the school, too. Girls were sleeping. We were all over the floors, the upstairs, downstairs. It was ridiculous, and me and another girl that were there become friends. We snuck out. We decided we were going to run away, and we were going to call our parents at 3 o'clock in the morning, and we did, from a laundromat. Police came, saw us there. Very nice, heard our story, felt sorry for us, let us play the radio. You know, I mean, they were very cool, but they brought us back to this place, and we're telling them, this is a bad place. And we get there, and they open the door, and it's daylight at that point. They had no idea we were gone. That's how many people were in that house. They had no idea two of the girls had disappeared. They had all been up fixing breakfast. And she shoos us in the house, and we proceed to hear, oh, don't know, they're just troubled girls, you know, like reassuring the officer that we're just lying, you know, that we're drug-addled youth and don't believe them. And so he left us in their custody. If he would have done a simple check, he would have found out that they had ran with us from Wisconsin, but he didn't. You know, he listened to them, the adults. We were kids. We didn't count, and he drove off, and that was the end of that. We got loaded back up in a van again and continued our journey. We ended up getting to the school and saw Debbie. She was there. I got to share a dorm with her. And one morning, about 4 days after I got there, we come down for breakfast in the main cafeteria, and the section that normally where the boys sat, because we weren't allowed to intermingle, the boys had their own dorms, and they were to sit on one side of the cafeteria, and we were to sit on the other. It was practically empty. There was maybe 3 or 4 nerdy kids sitting there where there should have been hundreds. They're just gone. And whispers and people are telling, oh, I know what happened. Apparently there had been a big breakout the night before. The boys had apparently planned to run away and did so well that none of the counselors even realized it until they woke up in the morning and saw there was nothing but empty beds. I mean, I guess they all slept through it, which must have been pretty embarrassing. So we decided we were going to do that, too. We, you know, they can do it. We're getting out of here, too. Forget this. We decided that at that night, when the counselors came around and said, you know, good night and started shutting off lights, that instead of complying, we were going to create a distraction in order to get the counselors focused on something else while some girls were going to have to sacrifice themselves by keeping the counselors busy so that other girls could get out. You know, we were all going to work together as a team, basically, you know, for the better of all of us. We figured if somebody can get out, we'll all get saved. So, you know, we decided, well, how are we going to, what distraction are we going to do? And we thought it would be really cool to start stomping and clapping the beat of Queen's We Will Rock You. We just, you know, teenagers, you know, come up with silly ideas, but we were like, oh, that'll be cool. That'll be so cool. You know, as soon as they say goodnight, we'll just start stomping our feet and clapping our hands to that beat. You know, that'll be the cue that, you know, we're going to do this. So we're all hyped about it. And that night, we're just all a bunch of nervous, shaking, and just, you know, we're anticipating this is going to be great. Counselors come around, they're saying goodnight, and come to find out, nobody had the guts to start stomping. It was just dead quiet, and we're all kind of looking around at each other like, are you going to do it? You know, everyone, I'm not going to do it. You know, nobody's saying anything, but with their the looks that we're giving each other, you know, we communicated quite well. So, and then suddenly somebody did have the guts, and I don't know who it was, but this lone person starts stomping out, you know, "We will rock you." By the second round, there was probably another 5 or 6 girls had joined her. By the third round, the entire dorm was just enthusiastically stomping and clapping our feet to this beat, and the counselors were frantic. They, you know, immediately realized this was a coup. They did not have to be told that. They could see this was obviously planned. They knew this was going to be trouble. You know, we're doing this, and they're going, you know, "Be quiet," and nobody's listening to them, and they're getting more distraught. And all of a sudden, in one of the rooms across from mine, there's the sound of a crashing. It sounded like glass breaking or a lamp, ceramic, something, very loud crash. Soon after, they're screaming, angry screams, blood, you know, people fighting, like, you know, pulling hair, kind of. That's what I imagined. You couldn't see it. And then all hell broke loose. It was like all of a sudden the dams just opened and everybody rushed the stairs because this was a 2-story home. And we all start trying to go down the stairs at once. There's counselors running after us. The girl in front of me, she decides to do this kind of leap over the wooden banister of the stairs about halfway down. And as she leaps over it, you know, like vaulting, you know, a kind of, this counselor reaches out and snatches her by her hair. It was just a lucky grab, but she got her. And this girl ended up hanging about 1 or 2 inches off the ground. It wasn't that high up, but she was hanging by her hair, you know. And she starts screaming bloody murder because obviously it hurt. The counselor's not letting her go. In fact, she's trying to pull her back over the banister with 2 handfuls of hair. It was just unbelievable. I mean, this was a big, big lady that was trying to pull this, you know, probably 14-year-old girl who weighed a 105 if she was lucky, back over by her hair. It was pandemonium. People were trying to get out the doors. One girl went out the 2nd-story window. There was a roof, you know, that kind of over the porch. So you would step out. It was not like she jumped 2 stories. She just stepped out the window onto the roof and slid down the gutter drain pipe, but there's a counselor screaming at her, trying to get at her, and it was insane. People were literally throwing punches because the counselors were like, they just went nuts. You know, I say counselors, but nobody there had a degree in child psychology. There was nobody educated there. These were all just religious people who thought that God is all they needed to save kids. They didn't need any classes on how to deal with troubled kids. They didn't need to have any degrees. They just needed the Lord, and everything would work out fine. And it didn't. You know, when things got crazy, they didn't know how to handle it, and they went straight to violence. You know, they started just snatching people up. And the girls, you know, were already angry. So, you know, when some adult grabs you, puts their hands on you roughly, and you've had enough, you're fixing a fight, and that's what happened. I ended up getting into a fight with a 50-year-old woman, one of the counselors, because she grabbed at me. She grabbed at my hair, but caught my earring, ripped my earring out of my ear. So now I've got, you know, blood going down my neck. She gets, you know, pushes me to the ground and literally was sitting on my chest. And I had, in an act of defiance, scratched like a pentagram in my arm. Not that I believed in any of that, but I knew it would piss them off. That was, you know, the whole purpose of doing that. And so I started saying everything to her that I thought would just make her freak out, which it did. You know, I was cussing at her, F you, and she's slapping me, you know, 1 cheek, and just like 1 across, whap, and then back the other way, whap. And every time she did that, I would say, F you. I mean, just, I didn't care. And it was a battle of wills, and she was going to beat that out of me, and I was not going to give in. I was just, this went on for about 5 minutes probably, when suddenly red and blue lights are kind of illuminating off the walls. And obviously the police had arrived. You know, what had happened was a couple of girls did get out. They were scratched, they were bloodied, they were crying, they were hysterical, and they end up knocking on people's houses that were not affiliated with the school at all. So 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, people open their doors. Here's these teenage girls who look like they've been abducted and beaten, and they're hysterically crying. Obviously, the first thing they do is call 911. So everybody got yanked out of the school. We all were put into foster homes, which they were scrambling. They didn't have enough foster homes for everybody. I ended up in one with 20 other girls. And one by one, I watched them all leave, their parents making arrangements, including Debbie. Me and Debbie, you know, ended up together until I was the last one. And my mother had not called. Every time I tried calling her, I had to call collect because, you know, these people, they were like, "You can use the phone, but you got to call collect. You couldn't make long-distance calls." And she would deny that she wouldn't take the charges. And days went by. And pretty soon, 2 weeks went by after the last girl had left. And I'm like, this bitch gonna leave me here out in Illinois, out in the middle of nowhere. She really gonna leave me out here in the middle of nowhere? I don't even know where the hell I am. And the foster parents I was with literally looked like casting call rejects from The Hills Have Eyes. I kid you not. They were just frightening. It was horrible. The last straw was I got up one morning, and I come downstairs to see, they probably weighed about 400 pounds each. They were huge. Literally, The Hills Have Eyes. It was just, she's sitting on his chest on the couch trying to pop this huge boil on his forehead that I thought was going to start talking at any moment. And I went, oh, hell no. And I ran back up the stairs and I grabbed that phone. And when the operator says, you know, say your name, instead of just saying my name, I was like, my bleeding, 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 bleeding. I didn't say my name. I started, you know, I knew that she would be able to hear me and just beg. She took that call, and I made a deal with the devil. She made me promise that I would go to Christian private. I would have agreed to anything at that point. I would have agreed to a chainsaw enema if it meant coming home. I didn't care. Just, you know, whatever. I had no intentions of fulfilling any of those promises, but, you know, whatever got me home, that's what got me home. And then I was a runaway again by 15 and never went back home again.
Wow.
Yeah. It was crazy, but I lived with my grandmother most of the time after that. But yeah, it was pretty insane, and that's a very short. There's so much I had to leave out because there's just not the time. It was, you know, every day at that Bethesda we had to memorize Bible verses, and we could not leave the room until we could repeat the whole thing by memory to a counselor. Yeah, and it was like two paragraphs every day, a different, you know, couple of paragraphs every day. It was horrifying. The second place was like summer camp compared to Bethesda. Bethesda was truly ran by demented people, and that experience is what made me an atheist. I mean, that was it. By the time I came out of there, I was a full-blown atheist. I went in an agnostic. I came out a militant atheist. Wow. I mean, literally, and never looked back.
And a murder seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this measuring of food. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I've told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die.
Interpret signs, the catalog, the black and the truth, the scarlet bomb, the walls of...
All right, that was Darlene's fucking incredible story. What a great storyteller. What an amazing, horrifying story. We're listening to the song Mercy Seat from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which is a wonderful, terrifying song from 1988, sung from the perspective of a man being sent to the electric chair, which feels appropriate to this episode because it's about American justice and how we deal with people who have transgressed. I think the mercy in the title of the song is probably ironic. We are an Old Testament country that claims to live by New Testament values. And I think it does kind of start at home. Again, I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but cut your kids a fucking break, people. Get over yourselves. Just be nice. Have some empathy for your own children is a thing nobody should ever have to say to another human being. Anyways, I hope you enjoyed that living, breathing feature film. Should be a movie. Anyone who wants to get in touch with Darlene to purchase her life rights for a movie, let me know. We'll put you in touch with her. It'll be a good one. On to footnotes. So the reason we were able to corroborate Darlene's story is because the mama and the papa figures who ran that first school were eventually taken to court, and all of the shitty stuff they did was revealed in court documents, so it is now available to the public. We can now see that they were bringing in millions of dollars by using such money-saving tactics as not feeding the children they were supposed to be taking care of. But, you know, it also revealed details of the beatings and all of the horrifying shit that she mentioned. And the school was shut down in the 80s, but this morning I Googled Christian boarding school beating to try and find this one article that we had used as a source when fact-checking Darlene's story, and I couldn't find it at first because it was buried under much newer articles. Go Google it yourself, Christian boarding school beating, just story after story. There's a video of a kid being tackled by like four life coaches and a counselor and beat mercilessly for talking to a girl in Virginia in 2014, which, by the way, was discovered by an investigation that was conducted after four kids escaped from the school and complained of rampant abuse. I don't know why I laughed at rampant abuse. There's a Christian boarding school, Florida's Dozier, D-O-Z-I-E-R, school for boys from the 50s and 60s, where 81 boys died from punishments rendered in a Christian boarding school. Anyways, the name of the school where Darlene was held and abused was the Bethesda School for Girls. They were eventually sued by former students slash inmates for paddling girls until they bled, holding them on 24-hour lockdown, and not letting them talk to new girls for the first 3 months. All those details Darlene mentioned were in the allegations. You can find all of this in the New York Times articles from the time about the hearings. The Bethesda School was eventually shut down by the state of Mississippi, which, by the way, not known for taking a hard stance against religion or corporal punishment. They were part of a group of schools, as Darlene mentioned, called the Roloff Schools, which were a group of Christian academies for wayward youth that have been repeatedly accused of abuse since that time. They got a big win during George W. Bush's administration when a bill was passed that protected religious schools from government meddling. They got to be able to do their thing. As for Mama and Papa, the Reverend Bobby Wills and his wife Betty Wills, who ran the Bethesda School, they started buying up land in the middle of nowhere in Missouri and eventually opened a school called the Mountain Park Baptist Church and Boarding School, where a boy was murdered in 1996 by three of his classmates, and which stayed open until 2004 when it was closed for beating its students. Amazing that it took that long, and like I mentioned, it's still going on. What the fuck, you guys? That's it for this episode. If you haven't bought tickets for our next live episode, you can still do that. It's at UCB Sunset Theater on this Wednesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. Tickets are only $6, and there are still a few available as I'm speaking right now. So go Google those words I just said, and you'll be able to find the page where you buy tickets, or we'll be linking it in the description of this episode. We're going to be talking about dogs and cats, the age-old debate, just all the creepy, awesome things that we know about domesticated animals. Cats are fucking awesome, terrifying. If you have an outdoor cat, it's actually like terrible for your local ecosystem because of how many fucking birds they kill. Dogs basically have superpowers where they're able to read our emotions better than even we can. I think you could probably tell which ones I think are evil and which ones I think are good, but we're going to have Jake Weissman there to defend cats. We'll also be joined by Carmen Angelica, Dan O'Brien, Alex Schmidt, Cody Johnston, and yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun and hilarious, and at the UCB Sunset Theater on Wednesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. That's it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Darlene Molina for talking to us, to Robert Evans and Amanda Mannon for their reporting on this story, engineer Brett for putting it all together. You can follow him at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack _ O-B-R-I-E-N. And yeah, that's it. We'll be back next week with more podcasts. In heaven, this throne is made of gold. Which I'm told of history doesn't fold down here. It's made of a wooden wire, and my body is on fire. And God is never far away. Into the mercy seat I climb. My head is shaved, my head is wired, like the moth that tries to enter the bright eye. So I go shuffling out of life, just to hide in death a while. There's a wedding band that's good. Tis a long-suffering shackle calling all that ripple. And the mercy seat is a-burning, and I think my head is throwing. In the way I'm hoping to be done with all this weighing up the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And I've got nothing left to lose, and I'm not afraid to die. The mercy seat is a-throwing, and I think my head is a-melting. In a way I'm helping to be done with all this twisting of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And anyway I see
so I know who, and none don't know me. Why? The mercy seat is a mountain, and I think my blood is boiling, and the wind is swirling, all the fun vile is consequences and truth, and an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and I got nothing left to lose. I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is awaiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this measuring of truth, and an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and anyway there was no proof, and nor a motive why. And the mercy seat is awaiting, and I think my head is burning, and the way I'm yearning to be done with all this measuring of truth, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I've told the truth, and I'm not afraid to die. And the mercy seat is awaiting, and I think my head is burning, and the way I'm
Hey, this is Stephen Dubner from Question of the Day. This week, James Altucher and I have a special guest host.
Brian Koppelman, introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Brian Koppelman.
Brian is one of the creators of the new Showtime show Billions. This week, we talk about what it's like to be the showrunner of a hit show.
I'll be the first person to just say, that was dumb, I was wrong about that, let's change it.
Also, why actual billionaires want to be involved with the show Billions.
They only feel burned if you leave them out.
Subscribe to Question of the Day on iTunes, and you can listen on earwolf.com or via your favorite podcasting app.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.